From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, my guest is Deborah Lipson. We'll be discussing the current international trade negotiations in health services. Transnational corporations providing hospital and health insurance services are interested in expanding their business internationally. We'll be discussing the potential impacts of this activity on health systems in the host countries, and also the orientation of trade negotiators and the pressure groups which exert influence on them. Then, later in the show, in our opinion piece, I'll be discussing recent developments in our government's military health programs. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Before beginning the news segment, I'd like to welcome a new staff member and two new radio stations to Public Health Radio. WRMC in Middlebury and WJSC in Johnson, Vermont have picked up our show, and we have a new staff member, Karen Klotz. She's joining us, taking over the area of development and marketing. Our first news item today comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. That foundation has provided a $28 million grant for a four-year-long research project to test the effectiveness of latex diaphragms in preventing the transmission of HIV and other sexually transmitted diseases. The study is a joint effort by the South African Medical Research Council, the University of Zimbabwe, the University of California at San Francisco, and a U.S.-based company called Ibis Reproductive Health. The study is set to begin in the KwaZulu-Natal province of South Africa and Harare, Zimbabwe. Researchers expect to add additional sites in the future. The study will begin this September and expects to enroll about 4,500 women from the region who will learn how to insert the diaphragm and will undergo HIV and testing for other sexually transmitted diseases every 3 months. Current research suggests that the port of entry for HIV is through the woman's cervix, so the research group will provide latex diaphragms to cover the cervix, hoping that that will prevent HIV transmission. Latex condoms have demonstrated effectiveness in prevention of HIV transmission, but require cooperation from the male partner. Unfortunately, that cooperation is often lacking. Hence the desire for an HIV prevention method which women can control. If the product shows effectiveness, researchers hope the Gates Foundation will help market the diaphragms at reduced cost. Another disturbing month in the course of the SARS epidemic. The World Health Organization has calculated that the lethality of the severe acute respiratory syndrome is higher than previously reported. Probably it's in the 12 to 15% range. While children have fared well with the disease, elderly adults have frequently become critically ill. The mortality among individuals over 65 years of age appears to be in the range of 50%. Fortunately, Vietnam, Canada, and Singapore appear to have their outbreaks under control, but the situation is much more worrisome in China. With the institution of more effective case identification and quarantine procedures, the capital city, Beijing, is faring somewhat better. New cases are down from 80 per day to about 35. In an effort to stem the tide of disease, the Chinese government has suspended the provision of marriage licenses in Beijing and closed most theaters and libraries there. However, the government has decided to allow the national college entrance exams to proceed, including in Beijing. The most disturbing news of the current month has been that SARS seems to be establishing itself in several of China's northern provinces. In response, Russia has closed many of its border checkpoints on the Chinese border. Thus far in the epidemic, China has reported a minimum of 100 new cases every single day for the last 3 weeks, and thus far accounts for 2/3 of the cases worldwide. The concern is if the disease becomes established in China, it could become a regular feature of worldwide respiratory disease, as is influenza. On a positive note, researchers are reaching a preliminary conclusion that the SARS virus is not mutating nearly as quickly as HIV and many other viruses. This should make vaccine development much less problematic. Reacting to the unexpectedly poor public response to the smallpox vaccination initiative, federal health officials have asked states to revise their smallpox response plans. Last January, the Bush administration had requested that 500,000 healthcare workers receive the smallpox vaccine before the end of February. By mid-April, however, only 33,000 workers had received the vaccine. That's about 7% of the target set by the Bush administration. The president's smallpox vaccine plan has seen a poor response due to the reluctance of healthcare workers to receive the vaccine, which is a good deal more dangerous than virtually all the other widely available immunizations. In addition, the extra smallpox funding appropriated by the federal government has not been sufficient for the task. Many health departments are facing budget cuts that are hampering their ability to perform their usual responsibilities. The budget cuts have been brought on by the fiscal crises virtually every state is facing, with the decline in tax revenues from the economic recession. Under the new plan, states will be asked to integrate smallpox vaccinations into a larger effort to combat a potential bioterror attack. Federal officials are asking states to develop programs to control a smallpox outbreak, including surveillance and reporting systems, staff training, public information strategies, and plans for practice drills of a simulated outbreak. That's it for this month's news update. Stay tuned for an interview with Deborah Lipson discussing the implications of free trade agreements on healthcare systems. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. At the well-publicized demonstrations in Seattle and Genoa, protesters expressed concern about an array of potentially adverse impacts of free international trade on the environment, on workers' rights, and on the integrity of indigenous cultures across the globe. The main health issue had to do with drug pricing. The pharmaceutical companies have repeatedly asserted their right to charge high prices for drugs which are still under patent protection, even in desperately poor countries devastated by epidemics of tuberculosis and HIV. But less attention has been paid to the international trade in health services. Multinational corporations, mostly centered in the wealthy countries, want to expand their health insurance business or their hospital administration service across international borders. In our interview segment today, we'll be discussing possible impacts of these transplanted businesses on the countries which host these new business ventures. Negotiations organized by the World Trade Organization have been actively addressing this issue for the last few years and are scheduled for completion by the end of next year. Joining us today to explore the impact of free trade in health services is Deborah Lipson. Deborah Lipson received her public health training at the University of Michigan. She then worked for 5 years at the World Health Organization in Geneva, Switzerland, and then at the Pan American Health Organization. In both of these positions, she analyzed the implications of global and regional trade rules and policies on healthcare systems. She was a major contributor to a report jointly released by the World Health Organization and the World Trade Organization in 2002 on health and trade. She recently left the Pan American Health Organization to become deputy director of the Better Jobs, Better Care program at the Institute for the Future of Aging Services, a program funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to study long-term health care services. Deborah Lipson, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be with you.
Deborah, why don't you start out by discussing the types of services the trade negotiators are addressing?
Well, the World Trade Organization is currently in another round of negotiations, and they conduct these rounds every couple of years in which they undertake negotiations between the members of the World Trade Organization, of which there's about 145 now, on a range of issues, including trade in agriculture, trade in manufactured goods. In this case, we're talking about trade in services. Services that are traded across borders is actually a pretty new phenomenon. Even 10 years ago, people tended to think that services were not a tradable kind of thing. But actually, a lot of things have changed in the last 10 or so years to make services more tradable. So everything from things that you can buy, services you can buy through the internet, advice or music or things that you can download off the internet are tradable. When you travel across a border to obtain medical services, that would be considered trade. It's not something you normally think of as trade, but in the trade statistics that are kept by world bodies such as the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, that's considered trade. So here we're talking about, with respect to health services that are traded across borders, there are essentially four types. As I mentioned before, when somebody travels across the border to obtain services in another country, another example might be when a provider, healthcare provider, goes to another country to deliver services on a temporary basis, which, of course, could be anything from 3 months to 3 years, but something that's considered temporary. You also have, like I said, use of the internet or other computer-based services or even mail to deliver services. For example, telemedicine is considered a trade in service when there is some sort of commercial transaction involved. And then finally, another form of trade in services is when a company sets up operations in another country. So, for example, if the United States invests in hospitals or clinics in Europe or in Latin America and then sells services through those facilities, that's considered trade in services. So it's a bunch of different things all rolled up, and those are all being discussed in one way or another through these negotiations going on right now at the World Trade Organization.
And can you just give a little bit of background of the history of these negotiations? How long have they been talking about the trade and health services?
Well, trade and services generally were first brought into the global trading system of rules back in 1995, so still pretty recently. Before then, they simply weren't within the same realm of global trade rules that governed, you know, back and forth, the tariffs or the other kinds of taxes that were applied on imports or exports of goods. But in 1995, recognizing that more and more of the world's economy is made up of services rather than strictly agricultural products or manufactured goods, the members of the world trading system, which continued to grow all the time, decided to bring services within the realm of the World Trading Organization rules. Those first 5 years, when services were covered by the rules, most countries didn't really liberalize or make it too much easier for services to be traded. But they did agree that they were going to start another round of negotiations in the year 2000 to decrease the barriers that there might be to trade in services more generally. So those negotiations began again in the year 2000, and they're expected to end by the end of 2004.
You explored some of the impacts of freer trade on healthcare and healthcare systems back when you worked at the World Health Organization, and you published an editorial piece that I thought was pretty interesting and provoked me to get in touch with you. This was in the British Medical Journal a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And in that piece, you discussed several different types of health services, and I thought it might be useful to go through them maybe one at a time. So, for example, one of them is if companies from wealthy countries are running hospitals or other types of health facilities,
mm-hmm.
perhaps in poor countries. types of impacts might that have?
Well, they're not always direct. It's very interesting. Only in maybe a handful of countries around the world would you see significant amounts of foreign investment going into the health sector of any particular place. But in a few countries, there are some significant impacts. Let me just give you a few examples. Thailand is a country that has been of interest to many different hospital corporations, partly because it's a regional center for medical services. So a lot of people go into Thailand from neighboring countries to obtain services they can't get in their own countries. In Thailand, it's a very interesting situation because you'd think, many people do think, that foreign investment in the hospital or the larger health sector would be good. That would mean there'd be new facilities, new equipment, new technology of one sort or another that can be bought or provided with these new dollars coming into the system. But in fact, Thailand did an interesting study which showed that it had some pretty serious repercussions for their efforts to make sure that there was adequate distribution of physicians around the country. Thailand for years had been trying to get more doctors to serve in rural areas and to serve obviously in the public sector rather than the more lucrative private sector. But once you get these foreign companies coming in who can set up hospitals and pay doctors a whole lot more, those efforts kind of go down the tubes. You just can't, the public sector or facilities in rural areas simply can't compete with the salaries that can be offered by these foreign companies. So as I say, there's some insidious kinds of effects that you don't normally think of that are important for people who think about equity in health.
Well, all the other developed countries provide health insurance for their entire populations. And of course, the U.S. is unique among the developed countries in that we have large numbers of people without health insurance. But I believe all the poor countries of the world, like the U.S., have large portions of their population without health insurance coverage. Now, you commented in your article in the British Medical Journal about what happened in Argentina when large hospital management firms came in to run hospitals there.
That's right. Part of the global trade in health services involves, as we said before, companies investing in hospitals or clinics in these other countries. Those companies are usually most interested in people who have health insurance coverage, and to the extent that they do come in and either invest in or manage hospitals, one of the first things they're going to do is try to exclude the uncompensated care. They're going to try to not serve people who don't have funds to pay to be able to get into those hospitals. So we've seen that already happening. It's a way for them to increase their profits, but it also has the effect of decreasing access to care by those who are poor and don't have health coverage.
Most of the issues we've been discussing so far as I have seen, have not pierced the mainstream media in the United States. But one of them has. On 60 Minutes, recently there was a segment on U.S. hospitals, which are trying to deal with the nursing shortage in the United States by using recruiting firms to woo nurses from South Africa and from other poor countries. And I know this was one of the areas of international trade that you mentioned, the health workers crossing international borders. And I was wondering if there's been much comment about this and much concern among the trade representatives who are trying to negotiate freer trade.
Okay, in those countries that are net exporters of doctors and nurses and others to mostly developed countries, there's a pretty difficult issue that remains in those countries, and that is that given the enormous health problems and needs in those countries, in a place like Africa, for example, where the AIDS problem is just devastating, every loss of a doctor, even for a temporary period of time, represents an enormous loss to the health system. That is one reason why South Africa has been pretty aggressive in trying to negotiate agreements with the UK, for example, so that they don't poach on their doctors. And in turn, South Africa has agreed that it will not try and attract or lure doctors from other parts of South Africa, Southern Africa, excuse me. But it's a very difficult set of issues for these countries because, in the end, it illustrates the global market for labor, in this case health professionals, pretty much trumps a lot of the efforts. And the reason I say that is despite the UK's code of ethics, which says it's not going to be recruiting from South Africa anymore, people still have a right to leave the country, to emigrate in search of better opportunities elsewhere. So it's a very, very tough issue that, at least now, I don't think is going to be hugely affected by the services trade negotiations that are going on. I guess I firmly believe that the solution to this problem does lie in stronger bilateral agreements between countries so that to the extent that people do leave their home country and in a sense leave the health problems of their citizens behind, there is some compensation by the countries that to get those health professionals. So there's at least some money to try to put back into the system and increase access to services.
Now, from a financial standpoint, the health insurance industry controls more money than the other sectors. And I know U.S. companies are increasing their penetration into the poor countries of the world. And I was wondering if you could tell us how large this insurance business is and what some of its impacts might be.
Well, it's not a huge business at the moment, at least relative to the kind of business that health insurance companies here in the U.S. do overall. In other words, their international lines of business still represent very, very small percentages of their total revenues. But it's increasing. For example, U.S. companies have been investing in many Latin American countries, and even in places like Britain that you would think wouldn't have a market for health insurance because they've got a national health insurance. But in those countries like the UK and in Latin America where there's deficiencies in their social health insurance system, in other words, they may not cover all the services that people want, they may not cover all the new technologies, there is a market, and that's what the U.S. companies are trying to exploit. The problem comes, of course, in what it does to the efforts of those countries to assure more equitable financing of health care. When a company comes in that tries to segment and take away the richest and the most well-off of the citizens, that means there's less money to put into the overall pool of health care financing in any particular country, and therein lies the danger. One of the countries that's particularly concerned about this development is our neighbors to the north, Canada. Canada is a system that does have publicly financed health care for everybody, every citizen, every resident in that country. And so they see the big bad U.S. managed care companies to the south of the border, and they begin to get very scared about whether they're going to try to come in and, in a sense, take over the Canadian healthcare system by, again, segmenting or cutting off those who can pay more, leaving the rest of the population with less money overall to spread around.
Now, it hasn't received much publicity in the U.S., but the government of Canada has undertaken a very in-depth evaluation of their whole healthcare system. And I know that as part of that very large reevaluation, they actually looked at the impacts of freer trade on their healthcare system. And I was wondering if you could discuss some of the findings of that report and whether they're in line with what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. The report that came out from Canada was the result of a year-long study by a whole set of people with all sorts of consultations and town hall meetings and various opportunities for people to speak about what they thought was important. The report, which came out from the Commission on the Future of Healthcare in Canada, had a number of different conclusions and recommendations, one of which was that Canada really needs to pay attention to health concerns in the context of its trade negotiations. As we've been talking about, one doesn't necessarily see an immediate connection, but those people in Canada who've been studying this issue have really looked in depth at some of the fine points and the details of trade agreements, and they discover, for example, that if Canada wanted to expand public coverage of prescription drugs or coverage of home health care services, for example, under the Canadian health system, that companies, foreign companies who are providing those services or have invested in those services in Canada, would suddenly lose their market share, if you will. They'd be cut out of the business because, obviously, it wouldn't be a private service anymore. It'd be covered by the public sector. If you look at a strict interpretation of some of the trade agreements Canada has with the U.S., either under the North American Free Trade Agreement or even under the World Trade Organization's agreements, that Canada would have to pay those companies a great deal of money for the loss of their business. And they get very, very concerned about that. So there have been some recommendations from this Romanow Commission to tell the trade ministry in Canada in no uncertain terms that they really need to pay very close attention to the public health objectives that Canada has held so dear and make sure that they're not threatened by any of the negotiations that we've been talking about.
Now, you've also looked at the impact of private health insurers entering the market in Latin America, and I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Yeah, I think we really need to take the example from Chile, which was very far-sighted when it negotiated its agreements in the World Trade Organization with respect to trade and health services. They have a system in Chile which they've been trying mightily to provide coverage to everybody in their country. They're not quite there yet, but they recognized how difficult it would be to really shoot for and achieve universal health coverage if they had to contend with the pretty voracious kind of marketing that goes on by foreign companies, usually U.S. companies, coming into a market like that and trying to skim off the most wealthy and the healthiest of people in any particular population. So Chile was actually one of those very far-sighted countries that said, we will not allow any foreign companies to invest in health insurance unless we give you permission. But, you know, they structured that exception pretty narrowly. Other countries were not so far-sighted. Brazil, for example, opened up their health insurance system to foreign investment back in 1996, I believe it was, thinking that maybe they'll have a little bit more competition, it'll bring down the high prices, et cetera, et cetera. They did not experience that reduction in health insurance rates at all. They had more availability, they had a wider variety of health insurance plans to choose from, but in fact, they didn't experience any kind of reduction in rates. So I think we have to look at these experiences in other countries and take those lessons forward into the trade negotiations and make sure that other countries who may not be quite as far along as Brazil and Chile understand the risks and the dangers of allowing that kind of investment.
Well, let's take a short break. My guest has been Deborah Libson. We've been discussing the impacts of international investment in health services on health systems across the globe. After the break, we'll hear about the attitude of the Chinese government toward foreign investment in health services, and then we'll find out what policies the U.S. negotiating team is promoting and the factors that influence the positions of the U.S. negotiators. Then, later in the show, I'll be providing an opinion piece on the policies of the Bush administration toward the government's military health programs. So stay with us. Thank you. This is Public Health Radio. I'm Marvin Malik. For listeners who are just joining us, our guest today is Deborah Lipson, who worked for several years at the World Health Organization, exploring the impacts of free trade agreements on healthcare systems across the globe. Now, Deborah, I know that you were part of a consultation team invited by the government of China. Tell us what you learned about the Chinese healthcare system and the attitude of their officials toward foreign companies coming in to provide health services.
It was a fascinating time to be in China. When I went there, it was in, I think it was September of 2001, China was just about to become a full-fledged member of the World Trade Organization. When I went there, everybody, it seemed as if everybody, I mean, the man on the street, the woman on the street, knew that China had become a member of the World Trade Organization. They didn't know exactly what that meant. Obviously, it was broadcast through a lot of the state media outlets that they have in China. But to them, they understood, and they did understand one thing, and that was very clear, that they were going to get a lot more foreign investment all throughout, you know, every sector of the economy you could imagine. They knew that. They were obviously excited for the potential it brought to them in terms of, an expansion in their economic status and incomes. And they were very excited about that, but they were also very concerned, actually, about what it might mean for their health regulations and their healthcare system. China is one of those countries that provides very, very little in the way of public coverage for everybody. It's really kind of awful in China. They used to have a system 20 years ago that 80-90% of the population had access to basic primary care and some reasonable access to hospital care. As China has moved towards a more market-oriented economy, their healthcare system kind of went the same way, and now everybody has to pay out of pocket for their healthcare. So clearly, when we went in to China to talk about the possible implications of their entry into the World Trade Organization, we took a look at what the trade negotiators had agreed on, and they had basically given access to European and U.S. firms to come in there and sell health insurance. Turns out they gave themselves about a three-year window before that could happen, and so we were telling them the risks, and their response was interesting. They said, maybe once they do come in, we better make sure we have regulations in place so that they don't skim off the cream, that they don't take away the little bit of money that we do get through taxes on those who are making money in the system right now, and be sure to capture that to be able to plow back in to the public health care system. So we'll see whether that actually happens. As is often the case, the trade ministry in China is the most important, the most powerful, and whatever they do pretty much goes. But you've got some pretty smart people in the Ministry of Health in China, and they're at least considering what their possibilities and policy options might be at the moment.
After doing background reading to prepare for this interview, it struck me that this whole area does not have tons of research behind it, either supporting the contentions of those who want freer trade or those who are concerned about the possible adverse impacts on public health. And I was wondering if you could talk about some of the problems researching this area.
Well, it is a difficult thing to research because the amount of health, trade and health services going on right at the moment is pretty small relative to overall trade flows, whether you're talking about services or goods. And that's the problem. Detecting the impact of something that's really pretty small, either within a national economy or in the context of the global economy, is a problem right in itself. The other problem that we found is that people talk about these things as if everybody knows what they're talking about, and in fact, there's huge difference in the terminology, in how they count these flows back and forth between countries, and in many cases, countries don't even have any systems whatsoever to be able to capture how much money or how many people or how many services are in fact being traded under all these different definitions. So for a researcher, somebody like myself trying to understand this system, it's pretty difficult and complicated, but that's one of the reasons why at WHO we had a meeting bringing together health researchers, health policymakers, together with people who develop trade policy and who track trade statistics, to be able to move toward a system where it's a little bit easier to talk the same language and be able to understand these flows, which we think are getting, are increasing on a yearly basis. And so ultimately, maybe in a few years down the road, we'll have a better handle on the impacts as well.
We'll have a better knowledge of investment activity and the movement of health workers, but will we have a better understanding of the impact on public health, which I think would be a much more complex question?
Well, that's right. You know, it's interesting because right now, I think the way the limited amount of liberalization that has occurred in free trade agreements with respect to the health sector has been pretty small. And I think what this does is allow us time right now to say, all right, in those countries where there's been significant trade in services or where there's been significant, you know, inflow or outflow of health professionals, let's really take a look at what happens to public health services as a result of that. For example, people say that if you it boosts health tourism, that is, the lots of the countries in the Caribbean or in Central America or in Thailand or even South Africa want to bring in more tourists to receive all their specialized surgeries and other kinds of elective procedures at a lower cost. People say, oh, that's going to boost the foreign capital and we can plow that back into the health system. I, frankly, haven't seen too many places where those extra funds are used to actually benefit the majority of the people and give them more access to health services. I'd love to see it, but I haven't so far.
You were saying that back when you worked at the World Health Organization, there were beginning to be discussions with trade negotiators, and you became concerned about the health impacts of breaking down barriers to the trade and health services. Now, when it comes to the World Trade Organization, we know that they have a position. Their goal is freer trade. So when it comes to this issue of trade and health services, has the World Health Organization taken a strong position in support of public health over purely financial and economic considerations?
There's no overall position. The World Health Organization only responds pretty much when it's asked by the World Trade Organization about what it thinks about the health implications of any particular case that is brought to the World Trade Organization. So, for example, when there were discussions about whether France was entitled to exclude asbestos imports because of its risk to public health, they did invite a few world health experts to testify before their panels. But in general, the World Health Organization has been pretty timid with regard to many trade issues. I think that perhaps some of your listeners may be aware of the World Trade Organization's rules concerning intellectual property rights and how those have been used to restrict access to essential drugs in many poor countries. The World Health Organization has been playing very much a backseat role in those discussions, saying, yes, we think it's good that you're talking about it, but it's up to you, trade ministers, to decide what you're going to do. And I think that's being, I don't know if irresponsible is the word, but it's certainly not, you know, stepping up to the plate and saying very loud and clear that health should take a priority over these trade issues. And that's something that I think many people are very concerned about.
So presumably the World Health Organization's appointees come from the same governments as appointees to the World Trade Organization, and maybe in most of these countries, free trade is just winning out over other considerations like public health.
Yeah, it's one of those sort of sad facts of reality, it seems to me, that economic issues tend to trump health issues. It's not something that I, in endorse it all. There's a few countries that believe the opposite, that human development, that health development is more important than economic development, that in fact economic development is only good to the extent that it does advance health and education and other aspects of human development. But in most countries that I have seen in my travels around the world, that is just not the case. It's the economy that really trumps everything else.
Despite the significance of these negotiations to the health of people all over the globe, these trade negotiations seem to be shrouded in secrecy, and you don't hear much about it in the news. There always seem to be other issues the mainstream media seem to find more newsworthy, like Saddam Hussein or Michael Jackson or whatever. But even if people wanted to learn about what's going on, is it possible to find out what our government's positions are and how the negotiations are going?
There is a limited amount of information that is publicly available. In other words, you can go onto the U.S. Trade Representative's website and find out generally the positions that they're going into these trade negotiations with, and you know, that supposedly is a reflection of consultation with the private sector here in the United States, but that really means that they are listening to the interests of exporters or people who do a lot of importing. It's not necessarily a broader cross-section of the United States. So in many other developed countries anyway, and in the case of the European community, they would make some basic information available on their websites to the public at large saying, these negotiations are going on, and this is why we think they're so important, and these are the positions generally that we're taking in these negotiations. What they don't tell you is exactly what they're asking of any of the other 145 members of the World Trade Organization, because they say trade negotiators need leverage and room to actually negotiate. In other words, if you knew exactly what position you could take and you couldn't go one way or the other, that wouldn't be much in the way of negotiations. So trade negotiators say, you know, we really can't tell you everything, we're really sorry, but, you know, trust us. It is very difficult. There are a few publications that try to have reporters on the scene, and as soon as trade negotiators come out of their meetings, interview people and get that information out. But there's still a great deal that is not available to the public.
So do we yet know what position the Bush administration's trade representative is taking in these negotiations?
Well, it's a little bit early in the game. I know that might sound strange since the negotiations started back in 2000, but they're only now entering a critical period. Between now and the end of 2004 is when the real negotiations get going on the General Agreement on Trade and Services, and we're just not sure exactly what the Bush administration is going to do in these negotiations with regard to health. One thing that does concern me, however, is that when you look at their track record on other health and trade issues, there is reason for concern. Let me give you an example. On the issue surrounding access to drugs and the interpretation of the trade agreements governing intellectual property rights, the Bush administration, and a little bit before that, into the Clinton administration as well, were not as supportive as they could be. In fact, now we're at a point in subsequent negotiations to give the poorest countries easier access to either purchasing or manufacturing critical drugs to treat HIV infections, for example. And the Bush administration is making it very, very difficult. In fact, you know, really scuttling the whole deal. So that's, you know, part of the concern that I think anybody should have about this. At the same time, when we look at other issues more directly related to trade and services, for example, water services, a real critical service for public health, once again, the U.S. Trade Representative has not been very supportive of trying to assure that any of those agreements maintain access to basic water services for the poorest. So these are both issues that I would say, you know, tell us that there's reason to be concerned, and even more reason that between now and the end of 2004, we pay very close attention to what the Bush administration and the U.S. Trade Representative are doing.
In the U.S., we have a democracy. That That means that the beliefs and attitudes of the citizens are supposed to find their way into government policy. But no one listening to this broadcast has ever voted for the U.S. Trade Representative. So how do we affect our position in these trade talks? Is it only through the voting for president?
Well, to some extent it is only through our votes for the president, because the president is the one who appoints the U.S. Trade Representative and the people who are doing the negotiating on our behalf in Geneva or, you know, wherever else the negotiations may be taking place. But we also have a little bit of potential to influence the negotiations through our elected representatives in Congress. They obviously do have some say in what gets approved or not approved. You know, the new trade negotiators may close the deal, but they still got to come back to the Congress and say, okay, here's the deal. Is it all right? And this happens in every country. The negotiators go back, their trade ministers present the agreements, and they're supposed to be approved by the elected body in each of the countries. So there is a little bit of leverage that we have. It'd be better if we had even more input into the positions taken by the trade negotiators beforehand. But as I say, they tend to listen not to people like you and me, but to big businesses that have big interests in exporting or importing goods and services. So it is very difficult. It's even more difficult, I think, for health professionals. And the reason is because all of these issues dealing with trade are usually so foreign, so outside the realm of what they're used to thinking about are real public health issues. So to learn the language of international trade and trade agreements is itself a pretty formidable hurdle, one that, unfortunately, only a few people have really tried to tackle. And so we really need to do a lot more education in the health community to make sure that they understand, number one, that there are these trade agreements that can have an impact on health, and secondly, to really try and understand the positions that would most protect access to basic health services and help promote a more equitable system of health financing.
Tell us what resources, perhaps on the internet, that interested listeners could go to learn more about the topic.
Yes, as a matter of fact, there's a couple of pretty good websites out there that I'd encourage people to visit. One is maintained by the Global Trade Watch, which is a project of Public Citizen. You can reach them by going to www.citizen.org/trade. And they have some pretty good information about the whole range of trade issues and how the U.S. what positions the U.S. is taking, and they're really a very good resource. Another one that's more specific to the health issues is something called the Center for Policy Analysis on Trade and Health. Their acronym is CPAT, and you can reach them at www.cpath.org. They're really very good. They're connected with the American Public Health Association, and CPAT has been very much involved in getting that organization to adopt a policy on the threats to global health and equity from the trade negotiations, both globally as well as regionally. I'd say the final one is to really pay attention to what's going on in our government in the U.S. Trade Representative's office. The person who heads that office, Robert Zoellick, is somebody who needs to be contacted. If you have concerns about these issues, and even if you don't, but you kind of think, I'd like to know more, it's important to understand what positions that the U.S. has taken. And their website is simply ustr.gov.
And you're also encouraging listeners to contact their congressional representative.
It's very, very important. Again, Congress ultimately does have some control over this. And in the last rounds of trade negotiations, there were some very important interests that were represented by congresspeople. So yeah, definitely get in touch with your legislator.
Well, Deborah Lipson, I'd like to thank you for joining us on Public Health Radio.
It's been great. I appreciate the opportunity.
Coming up next, I'll be providing an opinion piece on the policies of the Bush administration toward the government's military health care programs. So stay tuned. On May 1st, President Bush appeared on an aircraft carrier returning from the Persian Gulf to give a nationally publicized speech congratulating the troops for their discipline and dedication in fighting the war in Iraq. He was wildly cheered by the thousands of troops on the aircraft carrier. When he gave that speech, the president was widely viewed as supporting our troops. On the other hand, Americans who spoke out publicly in opposition to the war in Iraq were repeatedly accused of being unsupportive of our troops. In this opinion piece, I'd like to explore further what it means to really support our troops. Not every soldier who is struck by ordnance is killed. Many are injured, and some of these injuries will result in permanent disability. Still others will suffer from mental health impacts. Not every young person who sees the inhumanities of war can unproblematically return to civilian life. It's just not normal to see crying children with large burns or amputations, or seeing human body parts strewn about on the street after an aerial bombing. Still others have persistent physical symptoms, which are never explained. To this day, there is little understanding of what has come to be called the Gulf War illness, which has affected thousands of troops who served in the First Persian Gulf War. And all the consequences of the widespread use of Agent Orange during the Vietnam War are still unknown. The lives and suffering of these individuals receive little media attention. But there is a general acceptance in the U.S. that those who have put their lives on the line serving their country should not go without medical care. The VA system is supposed to meet the general health needs of veterans and also to meet their unique health needs. The Bush administration has made important proposals to reform the veterans' health programs. Unfortunately, these proposals receive virtually no press coverage. Due to the increasing failure of our healthcare system as a whole, the VA system is facing greater demands for care than ever before. The average wait nationally to register with the VA is 6 months. In both Vermont and New York, that wait is much longer. Rather than provide the VA system with funding sufficient to meet the needs of all veterans, a year ago, the Bush administration proposed to implement a registration fee of $1,500 for veterans with annual incomes over $30,000 per year. In enacting the fee, their economists predicted that this registration fee would deter most all veterans from registering. Congress rejected the president's proposed registration fee. On January 16th this year, at the very time the president was beginning to implement the plan to deploy hundreds of thousands of troops to Iraq, the Department of Veterans Affairs put out a press release which the media largely ignored. The Bush administration was announcing that veterans without service-related health problems who had incomes higher than $30,000 were to be completely excluded from receiving care through the Veterans Administration. When the Bush administration assumed office, they authorized the Department of Defense to continue with a lawsuit filed in 1998 by a group of veterans who contended that military recruiters had promised medical care through the VA to all who serve in the military. The government admitted that for the 15 years extending from 1941 through 1956, recruiters had in fact promised lifetime health care. But lawyers from both the Clinton and Bush administrations argued that the promises were not valid because they were not backed up by the actual law governing the VA. In other words, the administration argued that it was acceptable for those recruiters to lie to the young boys they were recruiting, and the judge went along with it. Now, care to veterans is not the only problem area. 217,000 National Guardsmen and reservists were called up for duty in the Iraq invasion. While some large companies continue to provide health insurance coverage for the families of those who were called up, most families lost their regular insurance coverage. These families become eligible for health care under a government insurance program called TRICARE. In addition, some of the military retirees are served by TRICARE. And though it gets little publicity, TRICARE is one of the largest health insurance organizations in the country. It serves 8 million people. Families which reside near military bases can get medical care through TRICARE at those bases. But those who live far from military medical facilities have faced major problems accessing health services. TRICARE pays rock-bottom fees to hospitals. Only 40% of hospitals accept patients insured through TRICARE, and an even smaller proportion of doctors take patients insured through TRICARE. Worse yet, TRICARE is renowned for denying treatment for patients who feel they require specialist care. Some stories of the poor care provided under TRICARE are available at the website militarybenefits.org. And an in-depth article on TRICARE appeared in the March 31st edition of the Wall Street Journal. But of course, even poor quality health insurance like TRICARE is better than no insurance at all. Nearly 40% of guardsmen who were called up to active duty will rejoin the ranks of the 40-plus million uninsured Americans 120 days after they return from active duty. Blanche Lincoln, the Democratic senator from Arkansas, led the fight for a budget amendment that would have allowed these reservists and guardsmen who do not have another source of health insurance to be covered by TRICARE. But her amendment was defeated, so these reservists and their families will soon be without health insurance. So back to what it means to support our soldiers. Anti-war protesters were accused of not supporting the troops. But looking at the matter in concrete terms, one's opinion may change. All those I'm acquainted with who opposed the war believe that because the war was unnecessary, every single young person who was injured or killed was injured or killed unnecessarily. And therefore, it was exactly their concern for the soldiers that caused them to protest against a war they viewed as unjustifiable. Exactly because he clearly has a low threshold for engaging our troops in military conflict, the president has a great responsibility to attend to the needs of our soldiers and their families. Of the 535 members of Congress, only one had a son or daughter who fought in Iraq, and no one in the president's family fought there either. So our country's leaders may be a bit detached from the needs and struggles that these military families face. But if the president and our congressional reps are going to claim to support our troops, I expect them to support not some idealized Stallone-like fantasy figures, but instead to support the real-life, day-to-day needs of our military families. When the president made his speech on the aircraft carrier on May 1st, he seemed to impress the returning troops, and perhaps he impressed the public at large with what appeared to be his support for our military. But when I look at the policies of the Bush administration toward the programs that provide health care to our military families, I see anything but support for our troops. In my opinion, the families of the young reservists who were called up to the Persian Gulf deserve to have health insurance just as much as the president and his family. The elderly veterans are just as deserving of the medicines their doctors prescribe as the president is. I urge you to contact the president and your representatives and tell them that military families deserve decent health care, and so do our veterans. Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.